If you would, go ahead and turn with me to Acts chapter 7, and we will pick up reading in a few moments. If you'll remember, Stephen is accused of blaspheming against Moses and God. He is accused of blaspheming against the temple and the law, saying that Jesus would destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us. And so he's brought to the Sanhedrin, and they ask him, are these things so? Are these accusations true? And so he starts his speech with Abraham, who every Jew reveres as the father of the nation. And I Googled the other day a timeline of the Israelite history, and even on their government website, the Israeli government website still counts the beginning of their nation from Abraham. And God promised Abraham children and land, which Stephen describes came true, but in the process, Abraham's descendants would live in bondage in a foreign land for 400 years. Afterwards, they would come out and serve God. Stephen skips now to the patriarchs, all of whom become jealous of one brother, Joseph, and sell him. He winds up in Egypt. God delivers him, and by favor and wisdom, ends up governing and managing Pharaoh's household. A great famine comes, and the brothers come before Joseph, and he saves the family. Stephen then says that when the time of God's promise drew near, the promise to end the 400 years of bondage, there was a Pharaoh who oppressed our people. He describes the wrongs Pharaoh committed and said, this is when Moses was born, found by Pharaoh's daughter and raised by her. He then describes an important moment in Moses' life. He goes to visit his brethren. Verse 24, he saw one suffer wrongfully. So Moses defended him and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He assumes his brethren would see this as deliverance from God, but they did not. The next day he sees two of them fighting and asks why. And they say to him, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me like you did the Egyptian? And so ashamed, Moses flees to Midian. Years later, God appears to Moses in the burning bush, calling him back to go deliver the people. Stephen now makes this argument about what Moses did for the people. Verse 34 or 35 and 36, it says, this Moses whom they rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge? Is the one God sent to be a ruler and deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. And now we're going to study verses 37 to 50. Stephen tackles a few more points in his defense about what he was accused about. So let's go ahead and read verses 37 to 43. He says, this is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren, him you shall hear. This is he, this is Moses, who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us, whom our fathers would not obey but rejected. And in their hearts they turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, make us gods to go before us. As for this Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And they made a calf in those days, offered sacrifices to the idol, and rejoiced in the work of their own hands. And God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets. Do you offer me slaughtered animals and sacrifices during 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? You also took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your god Remphan, images which you made to worship, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. So Moses mentions a great prophet, a prophet that God would raise someday that was like himself. The prophet would be like Moses. Jesus is the only prophet that was like Moses. Moses was a deliverer and a lawgiver, the one through whom a new dispensation began. So was Christ. And the Jewish people had come to expect a special prophet to come like this. We read throughout the book of John, in John chapter 1 and John chapter 7, there are several times when the people are talking about when this prophet would come. And even some of the witnesses of Jesus' miracles had concluded that Jesus was that prophet. And John 6 and verse 14 mentions people were saying Jesus is that prophet. And Moses said, "Him you shall hear." This admonition from Moses should have impressed upon the Sanhedrin the fact that if they were to honor Moses, they would have to obey the one of whom Moses spoke, of this great prophet, Jesus. Stephen had been accused of failing to respect Moses, but in reality, he's showing that the Jewish unbelievers of Jesus were the ones who failed to honor Moses, for they had and they were still rejecting the one whom Moses said they should hear. And just as their fathers had rejected Moses, they were rejecting the one whom Moses had prophesied of, which is the main point that justifies the conclusion that Stephen makes about them at the end of his speech. So Stephen emphasizes the greatness of Moses, of his works, of his exalted ministry in the desert wandering, of the example that he was. He talks about Moses conversing with the angels, with the angel in the bush, or, you know, the word angel just means messenger. A messenger from God, or it could be God speaking through an angel. It could have been God. We read in Exodus that the terminology, it sounds like God is the one who is there. However he operated, he is conversing with Moses on Mount Sinai. So Moses speaks with God and he receives the living oracles from him. And we remember that the word oracles, living oracles, just means divine utterances. They were described as living or lively because of their meaning, their enduring and powerful nature, because they are from God, which should have added weight to Moses saying that this prophet you should listen to. And so with this reminder of who Moses is, where he comes from, and his work, Stephen stresses Israel's rejection of Moses in verse 39, the one whom God has exalted. Throughout their history, the Israelites have rejected God's most notable servants, and those in Stephen's audience were behaving in the same manner. And so Stephen refers to when Moses went up on the mountain and the people demanded Aaron to make idols for them to worship. So they disobeyed the law God had given them through Moses. And he says, in their hearts, they turned back to Egypt because they had longed for the idolatrous ways of the Egyptians. And he simply says, our fathers would not obey. Moses is on the mountain for 40 days, and the people had said, they don't know what's happened to him. We don't know if he's coming back. It's almost like they're admitting, we don't believe he's coming back. And so they turn to idolatry. They make this calf. They offer sacrifices to it. They glorify it. In direct disobedience to the law God had given to them through Moses, in this very story, the same few days, within, you know, two months, through the account of Exodus, it says that Aaron made the calf, but Stephen here is really attributing that deed to all of them because they instigated it, and therefore they share responsibility in it. Stephen emphasizes the error of their actions by describing them as rejoicing in the works of their own hands, as though it were the work of their own hands that could lead and care for them, that somehow what they created is better than God. Well, because of their rebellion, says that God turned from them. He gives up, and he allows them to take this path that they had chosen until it leads them to worship the host of heaven, or heavenly bodies like the sun, the moon, stars, and planets. Many of the gods they worshipped represented those things. And so Stephen quotes this passage from the book of the prophets. You know, you remember that all the 12 minor prophets were in one scroll at this time, and so he specifically quotes Amos 5, verse 25 to 27. And in this passage, Amos covers about a 800-year period from the exodus from Egypt all the way to the captivity in Babylon. And during this long period, the Israelites worshipped idols, even though they have had direct commandments not to. Moses mentions this in his song at the end of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 32 and verse 17. Joshua mentions this in his final address to the Israelites to make a choice. Joshua 24, verse 14 and 15, he says, "Choose the God of heaven or the gods of Egypt and the gods across the Euphrates River." This is why God permitted Jeroboam to take the 10 tribes from Rehoboam during the civil war in 1 Kings 11, verse 33. And their rebellion is why God permitted Assyria to take those 10 tribes into captivity. In 2 Kings 17 and verse 6, over and over, the people forgot God, the God who made them a nation and who freed them. Ezekiel mentions it too in Ezekiel 20 and verse 16. During their wanderings, he says, their heart went after idols. It's a perfect example of when Jesus said, "What you treasure, that's where your heart will be." They didn't treasure God. They treasured idols. It reminds me of in 1 Samuel 8, verse 19 and 20, when the people were telling Samuel that they wanted a king to be like the nations around them. That thought really applies to their beliefs in religion. Throughout their history, the Israelites worshipped just about every idol of each of their neighboring countries. Almost all of them. Throughout this 8 centuries. So that's why God asks, "Did you offer me sacrifices during the 40 years in the wilderness?" By implication, no. But there's a little deeper meaning there. They did make the physical sacrifices to God in the wilderness. It's described throughout the books of Leviticus and Numbers, but they continued in idolatry. And people cannot worship idols and at the same time be a true worshiper of God. And so they had not offered acceptable sacrifices to God. They had been warned of this in the law. Before we move on, I want to read a few more verses from Amos. Because the Sanhedrin would have known these verses well. They knew the Old Testament. I want to read from verse 21 to 27. This is God speaking. Amos records, "I hate, I despise your feast days, and I do not savor your sacred assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them, nor will I regard your fattened peace offerings. Take away from me the noise of your songs, for I will not hear the melody of your stringed instruments. But let justice run down like water, and righteousness like a mighty stream. Did you offer me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? You also carried Succoth your king, and Chiun your god, or your idols, the star of your gods, which you made for yourselves. Therefore I will send you into captivity beyond Damascus, says the Lord, whose name is the God of hosts." I like that Stephen quoted this verse. Just for the simple fact of that last phrase, they began worshiping the hosts of heaven, But God is the God of hosts. He is above all. And one other note before we move on. Stephen also substituted saying, instead of saying captivity beyond Damascus, he puts it more plainly. He simply says, carry you away beyond Babylon. So Babylon's armies had to come from the north because of a certain river crossing to get to Judah. They had to cross through Damascus. That's how every invasion happened in Israel. They had to cross through Damascus. So that's a common term in the Old Testament. Is in when they were taken captive, they were taken captive beyond Damascus. And so Stephen is simply putting it more plainly to his listeners. And anybody preaching a lesson about Old Testament prophecies or descriptions, we do that. We all do that pretty frequently. So this whole description is just another stab in the gut of the Sanhedrin, really. Your heritage, which you hold in such high esteem, is generations of rebellion against God in their hearts. That's what idolatry is. Idolatry starts in the heart by rejecting God's chosen leaders and his will, then replacing it in your heart and life with what you want. And that's what the Jewish fathers did, and now the Sanhedrin had done. So let's read the other half of the verses that we're to look at today, verses 44 to 50. And I love how Stephen is weaving all of these topics together, laying on one after another. And now he says, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as God appointed, instructing Moses to make it according to the pattern which he had seen, which our fathers, having received it in turn, also brought it with Joshua into the land possessed by the Gentiles, whom God drove out before the face of our fathers until the days of David, who found favor before God and asked to find a dwelling for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house. However, the Most High does not dwell in temples made with hands. As the prophet says, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. What house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Has my hand not made all these things? So another thing that Stephen is accused of is blaspheming against the temple, which now he addresses. He says, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness. The tabernacle, then its replacement, the temple. The tabernacle of witness was also called the tabernacle of testimony. He's reminding them of its function. And it's called this for one reason, because it holds the two tablets of stone with the 10 first commandments on them, the tables of testimony. These things testified of God. And the Israelites had the tabernacle before the temple. One reason for that was so they could move it during their years of wandering. So this tabernacle was made in obedience to God's direction, according to the pattern that God showed to Moses on Mount Sinai. In verse 45, Stephen is talking about, you know, the following generations received this tabernacle. The second generation had this tabernacle, and they brought it into the promised land with Joshua. And God drives out the inhabitants of Canaan. And each generation afterwards had this tabernacle. They had this element to witness God before them until David came. So David asked to build God a temple. We read about it in 2 Samuel 7, verses 1 to 13. When Stephen says that David had found favor to God, it's simply a reference to how much God has blessed him. And so, because how much David had been blessed, he starts comparing his blessings, and he starts looking at his home, the grand palace that he has built for himself. And then he sees this little tabernacle, and he's thinking about the grandeur of it, the physical grandeur of it. And he thinks, why am I living in such a grand place and this thing that represents God is so much smaller? And so he asks God if he may build him a house. There was a problem, though. God did not permit David to build the house because he was a man of war. 1 Chronicles 22, verses 6 through 8, God describes the nature of David's life. And then he says, but your son Solomon will build it. And in 1 Kings 6, verses 1 to 38, it describes Solomon's actions towards building it. David was not a man of peace, but David got to participate in some ways. He got to prepare a lot of the materials for it. So this tabernacle, though it was divine in origin, if you're looking at the history of it, it is supplanted by the temple. This fact should have led the Sanhedrin, the Jews, to understand that a structure that was divine in origin could lose its significance, which is why he's describing all of these details. This was what had now happened to the temple. It has been supplanted by something greater. Stephen begins to make the point that even though the temple was built at God's command, God does not literally dwell in man-made buildings. No building made by man could contain him. He is the God of heaven. You know, when Solomon dedicated his temple, he said all this in his speech. In 1 Kings 8 and verse 27, he says, "But will God truly dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house which I have built?" Solomon knew it. You know, the Israelites worshipped that calf after they came out of Egypt, the work of their hands. They now had developed an idolatrous regard for the temple, which was also made with human hands. The significance of the temple was to be symbolic, and they missed it. The idea that it could lose its significance or be destroyed should have been a great possibility in their minds, especially because that was the second temple that had been built. The Babylonians had destroyed the first temple, the temple that Solomon had built. The Babylonians destroyed the temple that they currently resided in, was built by Ezra and Zerubbabel after the Babylonian captivity. In fact, Herod even made many changes to it, so much so that the common people called it Herod's temple. And so Stephen is driving his point home with another quote. He quotes Isaiah chapter 66, verse 1 and 2. And Isaiah shows us this incredible picture of how big God's presence is, but at the same time, what a silly thought it is for us to think that God could be contained within a man-made structure. And he's just echoing what Solomon said at his dedication, that its significance needs to be kept in perspective. God has created all things. His little human creations cannot build something so grand as to hold him. You know, Paul also used this description when explaining who God is to the Athenians on Mars Hill. He used this very description in Acts 17 in verse 24. So over and over, people use this description and want the Jews to have the right perspective of these things. And I think Stephen was also implying that their idolatrous regard for the temple could lead to a punishment similar to that which their ancestors had suffered because of their idolatrous ways. Their idolatrous ways led to the country's destruction and captivity. That's why he has woven these two thoughts together about the extremeness of their idolatry as a country and their view of these physical items and the temple that God wanted as a symbol. And we know, you know, hindsight's 20/20, we know from history that the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, destroyed the country. It was the same lesson that they should have learned, but they didn't. Most of them didn't. So this is an absolutely incredible speech. Stephen, one argument after another, based on the history of their people and the prophecies that they were well familiar with, he disproves their false claims that he blasphemed. Of course, the cards are stacked against him. And we look forward to Jim next week explaining to us, looking at Stephen directly addressing the Sanhedrin and their actions and their response. But for application for us, this should remind us about where our heart lies. Are there things in our lives, are there things in your lives that you have resisted perhaps doing something God expects of you? Or have you replaced something in your heart that you shouldn't have? Have you replaced God or a command in your heart that you should not have? It's one of these times that we reflect about ourselves, even though it's not a direct connection to any of us. It's always lessons to be learned from stories like this. So if you know that you need to become a Christian, consider doing so this afternoon. Or if you are a Christian and you have done something wrong, resisted, not obeyed as you should have, like Stephen's preaching, melt your heart and look at those commands again and correct your life. If you're a Christian and you've sinned, please correct it. And if you want our help, we can pray for you this afternoon. So if anyone needs help, please come while we stand and sing.